I said, no, I really smoked it. And I also inhaled, unlike some people claim.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Cannabiz. I'm your host, Wade McElwain. And this episode, I'm alone. Not really. Craig and Sean are on the road doing things. So I have a very special guest for you folks this episode of Cannabiz. Joining me in this episode is cannabis pioneer Abby Roach. Abby Roach is from Canada, has over 20 years of cannabis experience across so much of the industry. And she's here on this episode to shed some light on some of the cannots of Canada. What are the struggles of Canadian cannabis business? Are things going right? Are things going wrong? What could happen? So make sure you listen to this episode of Cannabiz. Joining us with Abby Roach. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another great interview on Cannabiz. I'm joined by the all-knowing and wonderfully Abby Roach. Abby is from Canada. She started a place called Hot Box Cafe early on. It was a weed cafe. She's been involved in the business for a long time. And she's a pioneer, really, in Canada in terms of the cannabis business. Abby, thanks for joining us. And please, thanks for joining us, really, to begin with.
No, happy to be here for sure.
Tell me, I mean, I sort of glazed over quickly in a fawning introduction to you, but tell us about your experience in the cannabis industry, how you got started and sort of how your trajectory has gone to this point.
Yeah, I'm going to, keep a long story short. I've been in the industry for about 25 years, not including selling weed as a teenager, obviously. But I started my head shop. A head shop is a store that sells bongs and rolling papers and just accessories without cannabis. In 2000, when I was 20 years old, I then added in 2003, the Hot Box, which was essentially outside of Amsterdam. And outside of Vancouver, I would say there was one lounge there, one of the only lounges in the world. So we ran that for 17 years. I sold it in 2019. In between those 20 years, Hotbox developed into a plethora of different sort of brand extensions. We had Hotbox Jamaica, which was a guest house hotel in Jamaica with a tour company with a little mini dispensary. We also operated like a homegrown hydroponic stores, a seed bank, a magazine. We had our own clothing line. We also had just a variety of different small sort of offshoots of the Hot Box brand, getting the word out to the world that cannabis is to be a normalized product and it will be legalized. And then post-legalization, I sold the business, as I said, and I moved on to the government. So I worked for the Ontario Cannabis Store, which is actually the biggest purchaser of cannabis in the world. They purchase all the cannabis for the province of Ontario, which is fairly large. It's the most populated, home to Toronto and Ottawa. I worked there for 4 years. I was the buyer for three categories. So I purchased concentrates, pre-rolls, and accessories. And I also worked on a ton of strategy around how do we convert people from the unregulated market into the legal framework? And that's consumers as well as growers and processors and people who have not yet entered the legal market. From there, I had a baby. I was a bit of a late bloomer at age 44. I decided to have a baby. So I had a baby, and then I decided to go back to private. And I now work for a company called Mara Cannabis. It's a privately owned cannabis company. We do really innovative, really cool products. We white label. We also have our EU GMP, which allows us to export not just flower, but also concentrates and vapes anywhere where EU GMP exports are accepted, including your side of the pond.
Holy macaroni. I mean, that's an incredible CV, really. I mean, including the time that you did sell weed in high school, I will include that because I think on LinkedIn, why not?
Yeah.
Congratulations on the baby. And it's always as a father, hurrah. I want to go back, obviously, in the CV. I want to start with the Hot Box Cafe when you first started it. You started essentially what was an illegal, underground cannabis place. What was the feeling and what was the initial pushback, if it was, from the government? From, I mean, you know, because you're essentially a pioneer taking a risk. How was the initial reaction from them?
So it was a really interesting time in Canada. I'll put it in perspective, where though it was illegal, what I was doing was actually compliant with the law. You know, sometimes I always say you got to find that gray line of the law, and then you just got to step over it by a half inch.
The canne of the biz, we call it. Yes.
Exactly. So in 2003, two things happened in Canada. One, there was a legal case that was won for medical access. There was a fellow named Terry Parker, who I believe he was epileptic, and he won the right to use cannabis as a medicine, and that was through the Supreme Court. So that gave access, medical access, essentially to anyone in Canada who needed it. There was no framework at the time, but if you were arrested as a medical consumer and went to court, you would essentially bring that up as precedent. And then what happened is a chain reaction of that. There was a possession case that was taken to court. It was in Ontario. I believe it was like a teenage boy that went to court for possession, and his smart lawyer said, "Hey, you just changed the rules for people to use, cannabis as a medicine, but you haven't changed the actual regulations, the actual framework of the scheduled drug. So therefore, you can't have one ruling for one person and not for another." And that precedent actually set up the hot box to be a quasi-legal place where possession in Ontario was sort of up in the air as a court legalized activity. So all I was doing as a person who allowed you to consume cannabis on my property, I was aiding and abetting your possession, which was no longer really a criminal count. So that was the gray loophole that I entered into. So it was a really weird time in Canada where the cops would come in and then I would explain to them that this is the situation and educate them. And they went, "Oh, right." And then my neighbors, I was in a very very bohemic neighborhood called Kensington Market. And I lived there and operated my business there for quite a while. So my neighbors were open and happy that I was there. And I think we managed to work with our community to involve our community within the hot box. So the restaurant portion, you know, all the food was purchased from the neighborhood. Everybody that was employed there was from the neighborhood. And we really created a community positive atmosphere, which helped us a lot, not only with the police and you know, the sort of government end of things, but also helped us with our acceptance within our own community, which then followed with, you know, the end goal of that business was normalization of cannabis to bring us to legalization.
When you have a lovely community like that, as you say, that the flourishes into a bit of an empire, you know, and it's a testing ground, as you say, to initially begin with. And it became a testing ground for comedy and other thing, the arts. You built a community around it that does give an idealistic and like, this is why we should legalize it. And obviously we haven't gotten to there yet, but so when you come to the point to sell, I remember when I lived there was a place like Friendly Stranger and things like that. There were some places they sold things, but they didn't sell things. And if you knew someone, and I lived at Queen and John when I lived in Toronto, so you could get everything. But how did it come about when you like sold it? Was there pressure? Was it changing? Did you see the winds of change coming? And you just were like, or I guess it was legal, I guess, by this point, but were you just tired of the fight?
Funny enough, I sold my business to the Friendly Stranger. That's who I sold my business to. Funny enough. But I had done 20 years and I felt like I had, as a human being, I had learned everything that I could learn doing what I was doing, and that I just needed to make a change in my life. The fight was hard, but it was always hard. Being an entrepreneur, it doesn't matter if you sell shoes or cloves of garlic or whatever, it's always hard. Entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart. But really for me as a human, I just wanted to grow further and learn more. So the next step that I took in my life really positioned me to take everything that I'd learned the 20 years before and almost do like an MBA in weed, which was an incredible experience that I'm forever grateful for.
Now, the MBA in weed, is that working for the OCS or did you actually go to an institution?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
No, it was actually where, well, after while I was on mat leave, I did do like a mini MBA,
Really?
but yeah, I did. But the 4 years that I spent at the Ontario Cannabis Store, I learned so much about the actual business of legal cannabis. Obviously, I worked in merchandising, and because of my position, I also got to work across with policy, with legal, with QA, and I really got to understand the sort of supply chain and how it works and what makes a legal product work in market and what makes it not work in market. I worked on a lot of really interesting projects, and I just learned from a lot of people who had a lot of really rich business experience in other industries. And I was there to support them and explain to them about cannabis, and they were there to really explain to me how everything else works.
It sounds like you went
So,
from gangsta to legit. Like
kind of, but
you
I
were
was
sort
in
of
the
doing it
gangsta of the
rough, and they were like,
OCS.
"Yeah, we're going legal now. Come on board, homie." And you're like, "You're a bit of the, 'cause you were on the streets doing it." And then,
I was, yeah.
and so you
Yeah,
were
but
like, "Yeah."
definitely. But it was still right. It was just the beginning of legalization. It was only a year after legalization that I'd made that switch, a year and a it was about a year and a few months. So they were still very much learning, and I was so happy and proud to be able to bring my knowledge and experience of the consumer into that setting. As the wholesaler for the province, it was really important for the to really understand who is the purchaser, the end consumer of this product, and how do we cater to them to make sure that they're getting what they want and what they're looking for within the legal framework in order for legalization to actually work.
And so there's a we go from the, you know, I don't mean to prospect here, but for the idealism, you know, of the hot box and then the OTS, and there's, you know, weed's coming, it's about to be legal, everything's happening, you're working with very talented people to make sure that this is going to happen, to facilitate the products, to look at what the consumer wants and their experiences. And where are we now? Like, how is it, how is the industry now?
I feel like, on a product level, the products that are coming from the legal industry are not only more innovative than what is happening on the unregulated market, and that's due to capital, due to size, also due to automation, right? If you look at vapes, for example, that's a great example of a product that the unregulated market just wouldn't be able to compete with a matter of scale, right? The hardware has to be ordered in scale, the automation of it, and then the formulations need to happen in a very kind of scientific manner. So that's a really great example of where a category in which legalization actually works really well, fulfills all the demands of the consumer, and hits a price point that they're comfortable with. If we look at inhalable concentrates, for example, there's a ton of really great innovation coming in, but the excise tax, the cost of manufacture is so high on the legal market, and that's a category where the unregulated market probably wins over us. So we need to look at it, on many different levels of sort of like the product funnel. There's the products that are coming out, what categories are we winning in? Where do we need improvements? And where does regulatory from the government side need to align with this? And in terms of the actual industry, I think there's different levels that we can look at. There's some companies that are doing very well and are very successful, and then there's some that are not so much, and then there's a whole lot that are not doing well at all. So I think if a company is not aligned with their core demographic and they're trying to just like I'm going to sell to everybody, that is a huge funnel, and you're not going to be able to get those consumers as involved in the purchasing of your product, especially with all the limitations that happen around it. It's better to just be more specific and more strategic about where, when, who, and why the products that you're manufacturing, the brands that you're putting out to market, their position. I could go on forever about this kind of stuff, but I think the companies that are doing very well are the ones that have figured out who their core demographic is that aligns with their core like operational competency, if that
but
makes
there,
sense.
But there's a lot of companies not doing well, right? And if I can, we talk about the cannots and the can-as of this. let's talk about the regulation. Is it simple, this regulation in Canada? Is it easy to navigate? Is it easy to challenge?
Definitely no, no, and no.
That's good.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's not good.
It's not simple, but, you know, we have to look at it as we are the first and still one of the only countries in the world where cannabis is federally legal. You know, while there are states that are legal, federally in the U.S., it is illegal. So Canada took a very bold and very brave step of going against all kinds of, you know, UN agreements and all kinds of world politics to take this step, not an easy step. And they didn't have a great amount of time or anything to look backwards to, right? So when they were looking, they were looking at Colorado. I believe they were looking at like Oregon and California. That was like, those were like the legal markets that we had to look at in terms of legalized. So now, 5 years later, you know, I think that we're starting to see things start to open up a little bit. You're seeing, you know, a little bit of relaxation around how licensing is handed out federally. You're seeing a little bit of relaxation around socialized consumption, for example. In Alberta, they've made it now, you know, I don't know if it's a license or a special permit, where you can actually, you know, have a consumption area with sales at events like concerts or special events. That's fantastic. That's a huge step forward.
That's amazing.
To be on par. Amazing, right? So, but these are all small test cases. And I think as we start to see, you know, things be successful and public health public opinion aligns with it as a positive change, you'll see that start to open up and change. You have to remember that, you know, 25 years ago or 23 years ago now, when I opened my business, people were afraid to come into a head shop to buy rolling papers because they thought the cops were watching them. And at the same point, selling rolling papers for cannabis was highly illegal. people forget this in Canada, right? Like until legalization, selling a pack of rolling papers for cannabis was illegal. Everything had to be for tobacco purposes, quote unquote. I used to say it was for herbal purposes. I didn't want to say tobacco. But, you know, and now we've come to a point where I can walk down the street, I can smoke a joint, nobody will even blink. I can walk into a store, I can talk to a bud tender about a plethora of probably, you know, 500 different products in one store that I have option from. And then as long as I'm a consenting adult, I can purchase that, you know, with a credit card if I want to. So we have to look at this as a timeline, right? Over 20 something so years that I have worked in the industry, the complete change that we now have is incredible. So in perspective. So I think if we just as an industry keep pushing the envelope and keep going to the right regulators with the right asks and also explaining to them, you know, how does this affect the greater good of the population? So we have to also keep in mind that 70% of Canadian consumers, you know, Canadian population, sorry, don't consume. They don't consume cannabis, probably never will, as opposed to, you know,
we can change that.
We can, but we may not, right? 80%
Hold
of people
down.
In Ontario drink alcohol. I do not drink alcohol. Yeah. You will not change my mind about that. Just not into it, right? And that's okay. But we got to legalization, not because the 20-25% of consumers voted. It was because so many other people voted. You know, I always say my mother, and for example, is a great example of, I come from a conservative family. My father loves Stephen Harper. He like loves Trump. You know what I mean? Like
Wow.
he would doesn't smoke weed. My mom, votes along those lines as well. And then in 2015, 2016, when we had that big pre-legalization dispensary boom in Ontario, you weren't here, but there was this illegal dispensaries everywhere. It was insanity. Kensington Market, I think, had 20 in 4 blocks. And people started to see that, hey, maybe having stores where people purchase their cannabis, not so bad, right? And my mother, along with me being in the industry, my brother-in-law owns a hydroponic shop. So the our openness towards cannabis and our open conversation towards cannabis within our family completely changed over the years. And then when it came to legalization, my mom voted to legalize. And she never has, I don't think she's ever lit a joint in her life, but that was one of her main focuses in voting. So once we change the minds of people who don't consume, who want to vote, and politicians understand that there's bigger issues. So by giving tax breaks on excise tax, for example, you're helping the industry, but in return, the cannabis industry, in terms of production, is based in rural Canada. You're not going to walk downtown Toronto and see a huge manufacturing facility or a big grow.
No.
That's all in rural Canada. So, for a politician, play your cards right, and all of a sudden you have a job creation platform for an industry that has as much contribution to the GDP as the auto manufacturing, right? And now you've created jobs in rural
But
Canada for
hasn't
everyday
Smith
Canadians.
Falls, I mean, didn't Smith Falls have a, I mean, didn't they, I'm sorry, but I mean, didn't the, it's now owned by Hershey. Hasn't some of these companies like these overextended themselves in some of this?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But it overextended, yes, but at the same point, we also the industry can provide a lot of jobs if it is profitable.
Of course. Now, I want to get back to a different point because you had mentioned just before pre-legalization that there was an influx of shops. And I think that it, to my point, we were talking earlier about social consumption sites. If, and to that point, if, say, Ontario, because it look, having lived away from Canada for 18 years, you guys really play by the rules. It's kind of a nanny state. It's like grandmother's house, nothing changes.
A little bit.
But if you were to rebel, and there was a whole bunch of social consumption sites opening up across, say, a province of Ontario. What would be the pushback? Because there's only so many people to police it. We know how small government and how cutbacks are. How
So consumption.
long before the tipping point would be where they would have to go, well, we have to let you have to consume it because we can't write enough tickets anymore. We don't have enough officers.
Well, that's exactly actually what happened. So pre-legalization, when the hot box was open, at one point, Ontario, mainly Toronto, had 13 cannabis lounges that operated within it. I think right now we probably have maybe three left out of those.
Wow.
But the change that happened is that, during my time pre-legalization, myself and some of my colleagues lobbied extremely hard for this and for consumption bylaws. So the way that consumption is broken down in the regulations is that it's owned by the provincial government, and it is aligned currently with the Smoke-Free Ontario Act. So essentially, it aligns with tobacco consumption.
Do it outdoors.
Prior, do it outdoors. But prior to that happening, prior to legalization, what was actually going to happen is that you could only consume cannabis. This is in Ontario. You could only consume in your own house. And due to a lot of like hardcore lobbying, we met with everybody under the sun in the Ontario province. And we lobbied the Conservatives really hard at the time because they were the opposition prior to becoming the ruling party. And we really explained to them, the importance of having spaces for people to consume. If you have parents, if you live in with with your kids, you can't just consume at
Hot
home. It's
box
just
in the
not
baby's room. It's
feasible.
not, yeah.
It's just not feasible,
She
right?
sleeps better this
So
way.
exactly. So again, politics be politics. The concession was, okay, you can't maybe have a lounge, but you can smoke anywhere outside where cigarettes can be smoked. And then you can also actually consume inside a hotel room or inside of your dwelling. So if you live in an RV or right anywhere that is a dwelling, even a boat that's not moving, you can consume in. So there are
Wade
concessions.
Cruz,
and
bring me on.
Exactly. So these things are written into the regulations in small print, in fine print. And unless you read it, you think it's not possible. So the next step really is, you know, we're never going to, no one in politics is ever going to be for smoking. It's just not a politically correct thing to do. But
they are for business.
They are for business.
They are for
but
business.
You can consume edibles and ingestibles anywhere. There's no regulations around it.
That's
I could walk into a restaurant today and dose it up. So I think the next step is there's two steps to the consumption portion, and that's on a provincial level. And as you see, Alberta is already doing it. So for outdoor consumption, and this is something that I've actually already in my past have done and people are doing now, where in the smoking section of your event, you can have consumption, right? So wherever you can smoke cigarettes. So people are turning their cigarette smoking section into just cannabis. So I do this quite often in my job as a marketer. It's one of our marketing activations that we do. We do a consumption area. Point is, for this to be a business, there have to be sales of cannabis. So the regulations around around the sales need to align with the consumption for that to make sense for you to even want to open that kind of business. Because unless you're selling something, you're just giving people a space to smoke.
So
right?
What if you open like a cannabis, if you got a license to open a cannabis resort in a rural area and you just had pitch a tent? Here you go. Here's a store. There's a toilet. There's a river.
Yeah.
Don't drown.
You could totally do that. You could totally do that. You could do that tomorrow. You could go buy a motel in Niagara Falls if you want to in the tourist area. You could open the office. You could probably get that license as a gift store that sells cannabis. And because those individual rooms are dwellings, not only can they consume and smoke in the rooms, you could also do click and collect and delivery from that store into the rooms. But no one's just done it yet.
Oh.
But it is 100% possible within the regulations of the province of Ontario. I don't know about other provinces, but in Ontario, you could do that 100%.
Abby, we're going to end the podcast on there because I don't want to give too much information.
Yeah,
to
I know.
On this
that's
because
10%
we're going to have another podcast on this. Folks, thanks a lot. We've had Abby Roach. Abby, thank you so much for being part of this podcast on here. This is fantastic.
My pleasure.
Oh, such a great
pleasure.
And we're
going to
have you on again when Sean
so
and Craig are.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. We're going to find the Ken Otts in the business. Thanks for having you on, Abby. Thank you so much. Holy macaroni, folks. What a great episode that was. And thanks again to Abby Roach for joining us on this episode of Canna Biz. Obviously, we barely even touched some of the topics that we wanted to discuss in this episode of all the Canots of the cannabis business in Canada and, of course, and beyond. We're obviously going to have Abby on for more episodes because there's so much meat in the bone in this podcast that it's going to take us a little while to get into Abby's big brain and find out exactly all of the Canots that she knows about in the cannabis business. If you would like to be on the Canna Biz podcast or get involved with us, hey, why not reach out? We've got a website, cannabiz.com, as well as you can find us on the X or as the Twitter, as the kids used to call it. Make sure you reach out. We would love to have you as a guest on Canna Biz to hear about your cannot stories of the cannabis business.
I said, no, I really smoked it. And I also inhaled. Unlike some people claim.